Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
You try all you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
I have tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I am Sam Amick, NBA National Reporter at The Athletic, coming to you as always. We got a new edition this week. We've been having fun last few weeks with our new regulars. We got Anthony Slater, Warriors beat writer out west, Freddie Katz, Wizards beat writer out east. But because we are going to lean into the Eastern Conference today, and we're going to start with one team in particular, we're having the one and only Chris Kirshner on, Atlanta Hawks beat writer and a guy who I worked with last week and collaborated on a story that honestly was one of the more interesting things I've done in a little while. Look forward to diving into that. And then after we visit with Chris, we are going to break down what we think are the top five teams in the East, since we have, you know, moving parts galore, injuries, COVID absences, all these different things making it hard to handicap the Eastern Conference. So that's where we're going today. Let's start with Chris, my guy, first time on the pod. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on, man. Let's dive right in. The Hawks, I mean, listen, the toughest part of your job, and you do a very good job with it, is that you cover one of those teams that does not grab the national spotlight all that often. It doesn't grab, you know, the mainstream spotlight. It's a you know, not a small market, but it's a team that, you know, the fan base has been down for quite some time, and you do a great job of making it interesting even with that. But last week, you know, you and I talk, and you had a very, very interesting situation going on with your squad, where after that hot start, they go 4-1. Things got a little bit sideways. Now, my disclaimer, and like we wrote, and like you and I talked about, is a lot of this stuff is pretty normal fare, but it's still fairly compelling, especially the direction it's gone since. You got John Collins speaking up in a film session, you know, fairly vocal about the way he thought the team was being run and, you know, the spotlight put on Trae Young and the way that, you know, that he thought Trae was running the team. And bottom line, Chris, they're not playing as well as they were at the outset. They look like a team that had, you know, all kinds of people saying, okay, like the Hawks are legit, the Hawks are good. And now all of a sudden they're, I think, in a 4-game slide. What's your read of this whole situation? Uh-oh. Oh.
He's just frozen in such a pensive.
Oh, there he is. He's gone.
I wish I screenshot it.
Well, Andrew's going to have some fun editing here, but I'm going to keep it rolling.
Before I don't think Andrew should edit it. I think we should leave all
this. That's what I'm saying. No, yeah. We should. We're going to keep going. So Chris, for the listeners, we'll get Chris back. We Wi-Fi problems. Got to love remote learning, so to speak. Fred, I'm going to throw to you since your handsome face is in front of me on this screen. You know, you know your way around an NBA locker room, and we've seen versions of this story since the beginning of time. How do you see the Atlanta situation?
I mean, what I think is interesting is from the way you guys reported it, and you guys have the inside info on this, but from the way that you guys reported it, it seemed to me, at least, like this is more of a basketball situation and less of a personal situation. Like I saw Chris, it doesn't sound like John Collins hates Trae Young. That being said, this has kind of been a theme.
No, that's what I saw on Barstool Sports. There was a headline. Yeah. I'm not kidding. So, you know, shame on you, Barstool, for being Barstool. They did do a headline that said John Collins apparently hates Trae Young, which is complete shit. That's not the case. This is a basketball situation. I just you set the ball on the tee for me to go at Barstool there. So go ahead.
There continue. You go. Go ball at Barstool. For me, I just think it's interesting that the basketball part of this tends to be a little bit of a theme in Trae Young's career. I mean, we've joked so many times about this being, 6 degrees or 2 degrees of Oklahoma City. Well, I wrote for the paper in Norman, Oklahoma, where Trae Young is from and where he went to college. And I vividly remember him when he was in high school there and when he was in college there. And it was a thing that his teammates found him difficult to play with. And I don't know if it got personal, but when a guy dribbles as much as he does, when offense has to be as dependent on him, I think it can be difficult to fit in around a guy like that. And we've seen that with great players who are known as ultimate team guys. I mean, we've seen that with stuff like Chris Paul, where you have to learn how to play with a guy like Chris Paul or a guy who plays that sort of style. So, to me, that's kind of what I thought was interesting, that this kind of stuff stems from the basketball side. And I also wonder, Sam, I mean, you're going to know more about this than me. How much of a part of the future of the Hawks is Collins? Because they didn't extend him. He's going to be a restricted free agent after this year. The free agency class now, with so many of the guys who we expected to potentially hit the market extending, you know, Giannis being the most famous example, but even like a Rudy Gobert and the rest of those guys, the free agent market is not as good now. All the top guys next year are restricted guys. And Collins is going to be very, very, very high on that list of really good free agents. That dude's getting paid in a market where a lot of teams have cap space. Like, what is his future? And does this mean anything for his future with the organization?
So I'll let Chris break it down because we have him back. Gotta love Wi-Fi issues. My quick 2 cents on that would be, obviously, if it's a case of, you know, Trey versus John and one's got to go, we know who's going to go. But I do think that for the right price, the Hawks would be looking to match something on Collins this coming summer. They just didn't want to give him a max. And to be honest, that to me is what makes this story pretty interesting, is I hear everything, Fred, that you're saying on Trey and his history and the idea that there's a little bit of potentially, you know, James Harden light when it comes to playing with him. But then you also have John Collins, who, we need to say before I throw it to Chris, turned down a $90 million plus extension. You know, everybody knows he sees himself as a max player. They improve the roster. Well, now all of a sudden, just because of the inherent nature of the game of basketball, and when you have more talent and you still only have one ball, it's going to be harder for you to go average 20 and 10 like you did, you know, in 41 games last year when you thought that was the thing that was going to get you a max deal. And so I think John worrying a bit about his own numbers, that is part of the conversation. He certainly pushes back on that, it seems. But Chris, we got you back, and I want to, you know, let you open up here. But what's your read?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I think if the Hawks could have agreed to a number with Collins and his representation, then they would have done that. You know, Travis Schlenk, and speaking with Hawks owner Tony Ressler before the season, said on multiple occasions that, you know, they wanted John Collins to be a part of the future, and Collins and his representation decided that they were going to hold out for a max deal. The Hawks were not going to do that, at least not right now, just because of the fact that, you know, through 3 seasons that he's played, he hasn't been fully available in any of them. He was suspended for 25 games last year. And while his numbers were really good last year and super efficient, he only did it in 41 games. So that is a part of the puzzle for Collins and what he did last year. So I think, you know, they have to figure out what number they would be comfortable at. Obviously, now that they don't have, they didn't agree to an extension, you know, whether or not Collins ends up signing an offer sheet and the Hawks match, I don't know right now. All I can say is they love John as a person. They love him as a player. It's just, do they love him at $150 million? And I mean, right now, that's the toughest part, because not only is Trae Young going to be eligible for a max soon, which he likely will get, you have other young players on the roster. DeAndre Hunter's look good in year two, Cam Reddish, Kevin Huerter. So they have other guys that they need to take care of. So it's just a matter of whether or not Tony Ressler is willing to open the checkbook and start looking at a cap situation where they are going to flirt with the tax, and they haven't won anything yet. So they have to figure out, you know, can they win at a high level with Trae Young and John Collins as the two main pieces? And I mean, through two seasons and nine games for the Hawks and in the Trae Young era, it's hard to tell right now.
Right.
You know what's surprising to me on this is that it's such an offensive question right now, right? I mean, to me, the long-term question about the Hawks is like, can you win at a level defensively if Trae Young and John Collins are here?
Slater, I didn't know if you meant offensive or offensive. I was trying to see which
way. Well, both, right? Another headline coming up. No, but you know what I mean? Like, to me, like, you guys might feel the same way. Chris, I should kick it to you probably on this, but like, I'm worried about if they can defend with those two, because I'd love them as two essential offensive pieces moving forward, right? Your pick and roll, pick and pop, four man with a lot of skills. John Collins is actually the kind, you know, he looked awesome in that like Nets miniseries. And then Trae Young, obviously, we know what he can do offensively. I understand that the egos usually clash more on offense, but I just got more defensive questions.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, because, you know, coming into the league out of Wake Forest, there were definitely concerns about what position Collins would play. Was he a four? Was he a five? Was he strong enough? And I mean, consistently throughout his career so far, he's gotten stronger. He's gotten better defensively. I think he's taken another step forward this year. Last year, again, I don't know how many people watch the Hawks, but Collins was much better defensively than he was in year two. And that's continued to improve at least through nine games so far. I mean, you can make the argument that John Collins has been the best player on the Hawks this season. Again, it's early, and Trae Young has struggled through nine games, but you know, I definitely think he's valuable, and you make a good point that there are definitely defensive concerns there. You know, I think for Collins, if he can continue to get better protecting the rim, which he has gotten better, it's more likely that a Trae Young and John Collins duo, if those are your two best players or two of three best players on the team, could possibly work. But Collins still needs to improve on that end, because as we know through two seasons, Trae Young is going to be the worst, one of the worst defenders in the league. I'm not sure how much he's going to end up improving on that end of the floor, or whether or not he wants to put in the effort on that end of the floor to get better, or at least be on a level of bad that is just like, okay, it's passable bad, instead of like egregiously bad, which is what he's been through two seasons. And through nine games, I mean, I think the effort has gotten better from Trae on that end of the floor, but again, it's still not very good, and you have to build a roster around him that covers up for his defensive liabilities.
First of all, I think we're ignoring the biggest story of the day, which is that Chris wrote his big "The Hawks Are Back, Baby" piece. And they've lost four straight since that piece came out. So Chris is the jinx. They've also had injuries, though. And so they looked so good through five games, and they were scoring like crazy through five games, right? How much of this is just like, I feel like, so it's the age-old question of, does chemistry breed winning, or does winning breed chemistry? How much of this just gets solved by winning? I mean, I looked into the numbers, and right now, when Trae Young and John Collins play together, the Hawks are plus 15 per 100 possessions. And when Trae Young plays without John Collins, by the way, they're minus 15 per 100 possessions. So that's a 30-point swing when Trae Young plays with John Collins versus when he plays without him. They're having success on the floor together. you know, they get Gallinari back, they get Rondo back, they get the rest of those guys back. I know Bogdanovich is going to miss a lot of times. Yeah, Chris Dunn. I mean, these are consequential rotation players. They're basically playing with the team from last year that they deemed not good enough. They brought in all these reinforcements. Now the reinforcements are hurt for a differing period of time. So how much of this is solved by just Danilo Gallinari coming back, getting in the rotation, and then playing at like a 46 win pace the rest of the year?
Yeah, I think it would solve everything. And I mean, going back to last year, just speaking to the guys who were on that team, there were a lot of unhappy people in the locker room. And I mean, they just straight up said, if we were winning more, we would be happy. I mean, like you said, winning solves a lot of issues. And if they start winning and they turn around and win four straight or five straight and erase this losing streak that they're currently on, then I think everything will be happy and kumbaya once again, like it was after that Nets win when they were 4-1 at the time. They've definitely been besieged by injury so far. Danilo Gallinari's missed 2 weeks. Chris Dunn hasn't played a game. First round draft pick Onyeka Okongwu hasn't played a game. Tony Snell, who they traded for, who was going to be a you know, solid rotation piece, he hasn't played a game. Rajon Rondo's played 2 games. So the amount of spending that they did in the offseason, these guys haven't played anything really. And once they're back, I feel like things would change in a positive direction, which is what they were hoping for at the start of the season. You know, when we were looking at the roster at the start of the season, we were looking at one of the deepest teams in the league. They had like 11, 12 guys who were probably going to expect minutes, and it was going to put a lot of pressure on Lloyd Pierce to figure out who's going to play and who's not. I mean, someone's minutes were going to get cut just with the amount of moves that they made. So I think for the Hawks, once they get these guys back, I do think that things will start turning in a more positive direction than what it currently is.
All right, Chris, because you got to jump in about 4 minutes, we're going to go rapid fire on 3 topics that come to mind for me. And Fred and Slater, feel free to give your quick 2 cents within that. Lloyd Pierce, who we wrote about in this piece, is in the last guaranteed year of his contract. This is the time of year in the NBA when pressure starts rising on a bunch of different coaches. What's your feeling on Lloyd and where he stands?
I definitely think Lloyd is on the hot seat. I think he knows that just from asking him questions throughout, even going back several months now. I think he realizes that he has to get this roster right. I mean, back in March, he publicly stated that this is going to be a playoff team. And that kind of caught the surprise of Tony Ressler and Travis Schlenk, who were not aware that Lloyd Pierce was going to say such a thing. So I think for Lloyd, he has to turn things around pretty quickly. I don't think it's a coincidence that Nate McMillan, who has lots of head coaching experience, is now the lead assistant and is kind of lurking in the shadows. If the Hawks were to make a move during the season, I mean, you have an obvious candidate right there on your bench to be the interim coach. So I think there's a lot of heat on Lloyd. He knows that.
And a guy with good history with point guards too.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that there's a lot of pressure on Lloyd and he has to figure this out soon.
The second one is after everything we reported, and then, you know, listen, they have the Tuesday film session. On Wednesday, Trey plays an incredibly mysterious game, shoots 9 times, you know, after shooting 22 the game before, struggled again in the following game against Charlotte. Your 2 cents on the direction of his kind of psyche and state of mind and where Trey is at after, you know, within all this context?
I mean, just from talking with Trey, I mean, one-on-one, he knows he has to get better when it comes to leadership. He knows this. The people around him know this. The players on the team know this. Travis Schlenk knows this. Lloyd Pierce knows this. Everybody knows that Trey has to be better when it comes to leading this roster. I mean, they're building this franchise around Trey. And if he's going to, you know, do what he did this past Wednesday against Hornets, which we reported that at least one player believed that Tuesday's film session bled into the game on Wednesday night against Charlotte. It's not a good look for someone who is supposed to be the star player of this team. He has to, you know, be better. And I think he will. I mean, just from talking with him, he really wants to win. He wants to erase the narrative around him that he can't win or you can't build a franchise around him. He sees all this. I think you wrote a story last year, Sam, about how he uses that motivation of people doubting him to his benefit. And right. he sees all this. And I think it's driving him. And I think he will understand at some point, he's 22 years old, that he has to be a better leader for the Hawks to reach their full potential.
All right, lastly, before you go, Chris, why did you seem to forget that your job is to pump out positive news about the Hawks? What do you? I look on Twitter and Chris is getting killed by the fans, and it just never gets old, people not understanding what we do for a living. And I'll be honest, this kind of story, and credit to you for doing a great job, is one of my favorite types, because there's obviously nothing personal about any of this, but it also really informs what's happening on the court. All those people who didn't know why Trey was basically moving differently, why they were functioning differently, it explains everything. So, and then I see you having to defend yourself, and good on you for, you know, making it clear to people that that's not what we do. And again, great job with the piece.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's tough because there's a lot of excitement around this Hawks team, and you write something like that, and you know every Hawks fan who's irrational on Twitter is like, what are you doing? Like I thought the Hawks were great, and you know why were you not protecting the players? It's like, again, it's not my job to protect the players. It's not my job to protect the coaches or the general manager or the owner. At the end of the day, it is my job to report what is going on with the team. And after Trey, obviously there was something wrong with him. Just watching the Charlotte game, I've never seen him be as passive as he was. You know, I started asking around, and obviously we found out the answer that, you know, this happened, and that was one of the reasons why he played so passively. So it's tough being a reporter when you have to write something quote unquote negative. People think you hate the team, or people think you hate the players or the coaches. It's not the case. I'm just doing my job. So I'm sure there'll be positive stories in the future. And I think they still have enough talent to turn this around and move in the right direction.
Yeah, no question. All right, man. Thank you for coming in. We'll talk soon. Appreciate you.
Thanks a lot.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, gentlemen. Let's spin off that a little bit. And again, we're going to break down the East and talk about, you know, kind of the confusing landscape there. But I want to keep going down this road a little bit in this context. You know, everything I talked about with Chris there about his job and the fallout that comes with writing tough stories, you guys have been through before. And I wanted to almost kind of open up a real quick story time because you both can relate to that. You know, Slater, I remember you and I, you know, this is not necessarily the most volatile story, but even like
I
writing
think
about
I know
Jordan,
where you're going already. Memphis Hotel, are we talking?
Yeah. Jordan Bell, you know, putting candles on Mike Brown's hotel room, getting in trouble with the Warriors. That upset a lot of people. You know, Fred, you've been covering, even this Wizards team doesn't come with the most rosy news on a consistent basis. You know, when you see stuff like this and these dynamics, you know, what memories come kind of rushing back for the two of you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Young stars clashing. I covered, you know, Westbrook Durant, as Fred did, kind of at the end of Westbrook Durant, and then he went on to cover. Although I don't think Westbrook, like Paul George, really had much clashing.
No, they got along really well, actually.
Yeah. I don't just, Mr. Unreliable. Remember that? I mean, you know, that was the Oklahoman headline that still is infamous to this day. And that was really my first introduction to, like, we had people, if I need to tell the full story, I mean, it was just, they were down Thunder, a very good two-seeded Thunder team was down in the first round 3-2. Durant wasn't playing well. There was this whole backstory of why we had this headline on the newspaper said Mr. Unreliable talking about Durant. And you know, you talk about a protective fan base, that early days Thunder fan base who was worried about keeping Kevin Durant, and you know, they ended up proving to be correct in that, but they basically that moment were trying to blame us for kicking Kevin Durant out of town, trying to, and it was like people were canceling subscriptions to the newspaper, and then that's when it gets real serious, right? When the business gets involved. So I remember,
let me jump in super fast, because I hear you on that. But that's a Barry Trammell story, right? Columnist for the Oklahoman. I'm going to drill down on that question and ask each of you, like, if the most uncomfortable moment for you where you wrote something and then the next day when you're going into the locker room pre-COVID times when we could do that, when you're like, I wrote what I wrote, you know, and it's true and I stand by it. But, you know, man, everybody in the room is looking at me sideways.
I got it.
All right, go ahead.
I got a variation of that.
Sure.
I mean, this is kind of a continual one. So when Ernie Grunfeld was on the hot seat with the Wizards, you know, about, I want to say it was about 3 days before Ted Leonsis ended up letting go of him, I had written that Leonsis was looking into search firms for front office changes. And Leonsis let go of him on that Friday, and I had heard interest in Tim Connelly was kind of bouncing around pretty quickly. And Tim Connelly obviously used to work for the Wizards.
Now with the Nuggets, GM.
Exactly. Now president of the Nuggets. At the time, he was GM of the Nuggets.
Right.
Now he's president. And I knew the Wizards had interest in him. And after maybe 2 hours or so, after they ended up firing Grunfeld, I reported and put out a story because I just had, I mean, I had a lot of sources on this that the Wizards, the top of the Wizards list was, I think I said their number one target. I said their number one target was Tim Connelly to replace Ernie Grunfeld. And the next day, Ted Leonsis, the Wizards owner, did a press conference. And when I asked the question, he started it off by looking me in the eye in the press conference and saying, I'll say, there is no list, Fred. There is no list. And after it, I'll remember, I was like, oh man, like I've been on the beat for like 10 months. Like this is going great. But you just, you know, the number one rule. And you know what? I learned this from, of all people, I shouldn't say I learned it from him, but the person who solidified it in my mind, of all people, I didn't technically work with him, but Barry Trammell always used to say to me, if you write something critical, the most important thing, or you report something or whatever, the most important thing that you can do is you show up the next day. So if anybody has a problem with you, they have an opportunity to say something to your face. And most of the time, by the way, you work stuff out. But Ted said, there is no list, Fred, there is no list. And then, by the way, the day after the Nuggets season ended, Tim Connelly was on a plane to Washington, D.C.
Right.
So shocking. I think you can say maybe the list wasn't there. Maybe it wasn't technically a list, but there was some targeting going on.
Right.
I think it all depends on how you define a list.
Right.
But that's the one that really comes to mind for me. There are the moments every once in a while where a player doesn't like something that you wrote. And I always find that when the player doesn't like something that you wrote, like the majority of the time, the player didn't actually read what you wrote.
Yeah.
Like one of his friends.
Right.
Yeah. One of his friends or a sibling or something like that. You read it or heard about it or saw like a, you know, one sentence snippet on social media.
Right.
And then that friend told the player, that brother or sister, significant other, whatever, told the player. And then the player hears a more exaggerated version of what was written. Cause I've had interactions where they're like, you said this. I'm like, I didn't say that.
Did
and then I call
it?
Up the story. I'm like, this is, I say, this is what I said.
Right.
And they've looked it through. One player looked at it and says, oh, I agree with this.
All right, we gotta get to the East discussion. Slater, give us yours. You've had a few, and I've been part of at least one of them.
Yeah, you're talking about the Jordan Bell one. I could give you 12 Durant stories. Obviously, I think that Westbrook was always interesting because, like, I remember once. Westbrook hated if you reported anything you heard in the locker room that wasn't like strictly, you know, hey, this is a scrum right now.
Approved. Right.
He was talking about going up to a Kansas Jayhawks, Oklahoma State game the next day. It was like a really big college game. And I was like, hey, like, you know, Westbrook and Durant are going to be up there. And they did. And they sat in the front row. But he was extremely mad at me for reporting that he was going to be up there. He's like, you know, these conversations stay here. And it was like in front of like 20 media members that were like just loudly talking about going to the game. But yeah, I mean, one thing I've liked about covering the Warriors is, and Sam, you know this, they really don't take stuff personally. Like you can be critical of Kerr. You can be critical of the front office, critical of Draymond Green. Like sometimes Draymond might make a side comment like, oh, you know, I saw that. But, you know, it's very, I think because they've been through that furnace so many times, they know the deal. So yeah,
you see, I mean, that it's funny because they, my last thought here is that, you know, Ray Ritter, head of PR for the Warriors, does a great job. But Ray came from the Lakers, and I wonder if that might be part of it. Cause in my experience, the Lakers, even if you look at the LA market, just to be honest about it, like the Lakers for the most part, at least for national writers, I can't speak for the day-to-day folks, but like they don't overreact to coverage, and the Clippers are, you know, far more sensitive. And you see these organizations who have, you know, had a level of success and been covered on a certain level just kind of reach a point, I think, where they know that the results are going to be the thing that cuts through all the noise. You can politic all you want left and right with the media. You start winning games and the noise is going to go down.
I got a quick funny one. Klay Thompson got really mad at me one time because they were about to go play the Cavaliers. This was the first post Cavs Warriors rivalry game where they were going to go play the Cavs with nobody on the team. LeBron was no longer there. And I did a look back on the rivalry and included in it. I was talking to Klay and I mentioned about, like, remember when they did the cookies and the, you know, all that stuff where it was like really ripping on him. Klay, very much on the records, like, psh, those bums. And like had some weird Klay Thompson thing where he called them bums. And I put it in the story and it came out. And of course, like Bleacher Report grabs it. That's the headline. Like Klay Thompson calls LeBron James and the Cavaliers bums or something like that. And it was framed poorly in the aggregation world, but clearly Klay only saw it in the aggregation world. Right. And yeah, he was like, I remember him coming off the court. I was like, hey, look, I've heard you're not happy with it. Let's talk. And he was like, I don't want to talk. He was kind of like storming off. And that's a guy who normally you would assume isn't connected to it at all, but some stuff randomly sets guys off.
Yep. All right, let's get to the East. So I've shared my stories before and I'll do it some other time. I want to get into this other topic. Guys, we knew this season was going to be rocky. We knew it was going to have the COVID factor. It's pretty bad right now. I don't know the tally. I'm kind of losing track of how many teams are impacted, how many players, but you're talking big names. You're talking Jason Tatum's, Bradley Beal's. We have the, you know, mysterious is a little salacious, but like the unexplained Kyrie Irving personal reasons absence that people don't know if it's him reacting to what's happening in the world, if there's a personal situation, but Kyrie's been out for a number of games with the Nets. Kevin Durant just came back. Our Shams Charania reported this morning that the league has no plans on suspending the season. They're going to soldier ahead and try to get through this. But specifically on the East, it has just created this incredibly muddled environment where early on it was, man, the Nets look amazing and the Nets are going to be in the finals. And then it's like, okay, Philly's winning some games. Fred, let me throw it to you. We were going to do a little homework here and try to talk about what we think are our top five teams in the East. How are you seeing it right now?
All right. The East makes no sense.
No question.
It makes no sense. And I think the Nets are the ultimate microcosm of the East. Okay, so a great way to tell who are the real contenders, and it's a little bit too early for this, but whatever. Early season stats can be fun in that sometimes when they make no sense, that's just the fun of it. And this is truly one of them. So like a great way to tell contenders when you're looking at it is you look at the balanced teams, right? It's not the case every single year, but it tends to be true more often than not that your champion is going to be a team that's top 10 defense, top 10 offense. And it's probably going to be true on both sides of the ball. You probably don't have a team that like sucks on one side of the ball that ends up winning the conference. Every once in a while, you get a team that's just barely outside the top 10 that wins the conference, but it doesn't happen very often. The Nets are the only team in the Eastern Conference that are top 10 in defense and top 10 in offense, and they're below 500.
Right.
They have beaten the majority of their wins have come against winning teams, and I believe that all of their losses have come to teams that are 500 or worse. Like they make no sense. And I know they've missed Kyrie Irving some, and they've missed Kevin Durant some.
They also make no sense because you have a different roster every night. Spencer Dinwiddie obviously is out. You know, Caris LeVert's going from shooting, you know, two times one night to being the guy who's got to do everything the next. I mean, their thing has been extreme.
It's just incredibly difficult to evaluate, and it's incredibly difficult to evaluate so many of these teams on a night-to-night basis because it's not just that guys are starting to miss time because of, you know, health and safety protocol stuff, which is obvious and obviously starting to become more and more of a problem every day. It's also that because of the schedule, teams aren't really practicing. One of the things that I think is kind of an interesting trend of this year, maybe this is just too inside basketball, but that for the most part, teams aren't really shooting around. And shoot-arounds were kind of getting, you know, they were a lost art anyway.
Right.
But now we're really losing it because teams have to come in super early for their rapid tests. And so are you really going to lose an hour or an hour and a half of sleep on the road just to be able to get a shoot around? Like, game day routines are different. Players' game day routines are different. So many guys are creatures of habits. We're seeing tons of blowouts. The league is weird. And the Nets are such a microcosm of that to me. They're very difficult to make out because they look excellent sometimes. I mean, even I watch their defense. And I watched them give up a gazillion points to the Thunder. And the eye test looks so ugly. And yet you look at the numbers and, like, they've been pretty good defensively. That's what's propping them up. It's just, it's a very strange team.
Yeah, they are. I'm looking here. Yeah, the Nets are third in defensive rating in the East. I'm looking just at the Eastern side here. Shout out NBA.com/stats. So, Fred, where are the Nets on your list? And what's your top five?
I'm putting the Nets at five right now.
Okay.
I like what they're doing. I'm gonna go Indiana at four. And I'm gonna go Miami at three, I should say. Philly at two. And wait. Nope, I have my list backwards. So this is great podcasting. So can Slater let's go and let me figure this out.
Should we just start at the top? Who's everybody's number one?
I got Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I'm going to not say Milwaukee. I mean, I know obviously the regular season stat. Like, are we talking about who do we think is most likely to come out of the East or who's most likely to be the number one
seed? I'm doing who's, I mean, I guess mine, for me, it qualifies for both. Who I think will come out of the East and then who do I have atop that list right now?
Yeah, I think with what Fred's talking about with like the weirdness of this season makes me just kind of look at it from a wider scope, maybe look at what individual players are looking like. Like Joel Embiid looks awesome in Philadelphia right now. That's a very good sign for Philly. But I, you know, we saw this with Milwaukee last season, right? If we did this podcast last year, we would have come on every week. And if every week we said who's going to win the East, we oftentimes would have said Milwaukee. We never would have said Miami, right? But nothing's really changed with Miami much. I mean, I know they lost Jay Crowder, but like they basically have the core of the team that really kind of muscled through Milwaukee 4-1. I know it was the bubble environment, whatever you want to say. Giannis is still looking like the exact same player. He's 26% from three. He's not shooting well on free throws. To me, in a playoff environment, I just trust
Drew
Miami.
Holiday shade.
No,
Drew
I mean,
Holiday shade.
Look, he will help. He will help. But, you know, I think I'm going to say I'll believe it when I see it with Milwaukee up until the moment where they show me, right? I mean,
I don't mind being wrong again. It was a lot of fun covering Miami in the finals in the bubble and what they did to the Bucks. I certainly haven't forgotten, looking at it here so far. And again, I'm losing track of who they've had and who they haven't had at different times. Jimmy's missed some games. Jimmy Butler, obviously. But the Heat currently have the eighth best net rating in the East. So from that standpoint, you know, they're off to a sluggish start.
Yeah, no, for sure. But who right now? Who do you trust more in a playoff setting? Let's look at the Nets. Fred was talking about the Nets, the version of Kevin Durant and Kyrie that we've seen, or Giannis and Drew Holiday.
Well, I think one of the things is I still have question marks about the Nets defense, And Milwaukee right now is scoring like maniacs. I mean, it's crazy.
They're shooting 42% from three, which that seems a little unsustainable. I mean, that would be like almost record. But I mean, I'm almost just trying to like devil's advocate Milwaukee a little bit, because like clearly
they haven't done it. Yeah, they haven't done it. And that part they got to do.
Yeah, and, by the way, to me, it's the concern with Giannis at a playoff level. And like to me, the game just looks the same, right? And we all know, like in the regular season, you're just randomly playing the Raptors tonight. You're playing the Magic, whatever. Like that can work in a one game sample. Miami showed they're going to play a specific, you know, defensive style over the course of a 7-game series that's going to frustrate him if he can't hit the mid-ranger consistently and he can't hit the three. And you can foul him because he's only going to hit 60% of his free throws, let's say. So I just like still kind of have the same structural concern about Milwaukee and Giannis in a playoffs that I don't necessarily have with a team that has Durant and Kyrie, or with Miami, who kind of showed it last year.
Just a quick stat to fill in on the Bucks front, probably not sustainable offensively at this rate. They're almost 3 points better per 100 possessions than the Dallas Mavericks team last year that had the best offensive rating in the history of basketball. So the Bucks are on a historic pace. The defense has been the surprising part. I think they're like 14th overall. But to your general points later, the Bucks have not earned playoff trust. I do think we should, you know, hone in on, you know, mostly the early goings here. But I hear you for sure on the reputations and kind of the lack of trust there.
And for what it's worth, Eric Name had a really good story up in The Athletic today about kind of the edits the Bucks have made to their offense this year. Part of the reason they've had the success. I mean, you look at some of their percentages, they're ridiculous. Like DiVincenzo and Middleton are shooting out of this world. I think Middleton is shooting 65% on long twos, which is just outrageous. He was 55% last year, by the way. That dude just scores from everywhere. But they've made edits to their offense, and Eric specifically talked a lot about how they're putting guys a lot more in the dunker spot this year, meaning essentially they're playing an off-ball guy inside the three-point line more than they did last year. There's some more motion, or a lot more motion, inside the three-point line, and that could be something I think that could help them. It adds part of their problem last year, I thought, was that they were somewhat predictable. They don't play the same way as Houston, but their issue, when you boil it down to the basics, is predictability in the playoffs. Over 7 games, a smart coach figures out predictability. A smart team figures out predictability. I think they have a little bit more spontaneity in their offense this year than they did last year, and I could see that being something that could help them. I also just get the vibes that like this is an over-the-hump situation. Like at some point, the great player gets over the hump.
Right.
And then 6 years later, we look back at it and we're like, remember when we said Giannis couldn't win the East? Like this has those
true,
vibes.
True, but it could be a Dirk situation, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Sure.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out 6 pop culture themed trophies for 6 basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out 6 pop culture themed trophies for 6 basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
So it, in the interest of keeping the podcast timely, as a quick aside, and I'm sure your phones are also blowing up, the Pelicans-Mavericks game has been postponed. And so, you know, the COVID impact continues. As far as the top five list, though, so we got Fred and I with Milwaukee, and Slater, you going Miami with number one?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm saying this from not the first whatever games. I'm still saying it on who I trust to win the East.
You're on team Jimmy Buckets. I hear you. And bam, you know.
And I think number two, I would say the Nets, because
yeah,
I think the most influential thing in the Eastern Conference I've seen over the first 10 games is Kevin Durant. Looks like Kevin Durant. Will that long term? Yeah, I know we've had this discussion. We'll see. But, you know, the most proven playoff player in the Eastern Conference is Kevin Durant. And Kyrie might be like number two, honestly. So I don't know if they're going to be healthy, but.
So I have to, you know, full disclosure admission here. We give you guys homework and you do your homework and you have your top five list. And then I'm over here having fun looking at my five and deciding that I'm going to interchange depending on what I hear. I'm just going to be honest.
Hey, but, I read mine backwards, Sam.
Yeah, there you go.
Mine was completely backwards. I had mine completely reversed. So I actually, it wasn't even backwards. It was scrambled. So.
Slater has got, so we're going to hone in. I like this format. We'll go, you know, each spot for the three of us. So number two. For me, I can't give it to Brooklyn just because I am trying to hone in on what's actually happened, but Durant looks amazing. You know, I have basketball concerns about Kyrie in terms of just, you know, where his head is at, because we know, and I respect the heck out of this, but if you go back to the bubble, he obviously didn't want to play, you know, largely because he felt like it was inappropriate given the social justice issues of our time, you know, and then now again, we haven't heard from him on why he's not playing, but that kind of trend and pattern is something that basketball wise could interrupt what they are trying to accomplish going forward. So that would be, I think that's fair to say. So number two for me, it's, you know, somewhat hesitantly saying Philly. Record wise, you know, they've been out to a good start. Joel Embiid has put up MVP caliber numbers. Ben Simmons being Ben Simmons, not scoring nearly as much as I'm sure, you know, former Rockets GM and James Harden lover Daryl Morey would like him to. But defensively, they've been fantastic. So, you know, I got Philly there, but it's a little bit, I think, of a paper tiger situation so far. If you really break down what they've done, it's been good, but it's certainly you got to keep convincing me.
It was interesting. I was talking actually to Steph Curry a little bit about Philly last night because, you know, as you just mentioned, we're looking at alerts on our phone. Oh, another game's canceled. Steph's brother has coronavirus right now. And, you know, when we take stuff out to the real world, like he's worried about his brother who has a newborn baby with his wife, who is Doc Rivers' daughter, is his wife. And, you know, it was interesting because the Warriors are hot right now and Steph's kind of feeling good about the team, but he was talking about being reminded, particularly during this season, a rug can just be pulled out right from under you. And that rug for the Sixers was they're 7-1. Seth Curry is the best 3-point shooter in the league. And I said Seth, not Steph right now. Seth Curry is shooting 60% from three, and he's added an element to that Sixers team that they didn't have last year, right? Just a spacer that is just like, you know, lethal from deep. But as they're 7-1, suddenly Seth Curry tests positive for coronavirus, which, you know, triggers contact tracing. And they had that game against the Nuggets the other day that probably would have been like a really big highlight game for the NBA, but they only end up having eight players. Tyrese Maxey has to be their like go-to scorer in it. Joel Embiid, who has a newborn of his own, is like all kind of worried. And I agree with like the 8-game sample where they were 7-1, they looked like they were heading in a really good direction, but
losing to Brooklyn with no Durant, no Irving was a bad look. That one, obviously, you know, they let their guard down thinking, you know, they were playing a bunch of nobodies, but you know, they've obviously lost two in a row now.
But yeah,
they've had an easy schedule too, for the most part.
Wizards twice.
They dropped to the Eastern Conference's or lost to the Eastern Conference's best defensive team, the Joe Varden's Cleveland Cavaliers, which is something I never thought I would say.
I think they're clearly structured better. Morey did a good job this summer, I think, is what we're seeing. Like,
no, the shooting has helped. Yeah. Tobias Harris reuniting with Doc Rivers, you know, that's a positive. You know, the Embiid. Question that continues to loom. Yeah, no, Embiid's been great, and they're changing how they use him. And so, you know, it's a little bit, it's funny, as much as, not to stick on Philly too much, but as much as Doc Rivers has accomplished in his pretty incredible playing and coaching career, not so much executive career, but that's all right. It feels like a got something to prove year, even for Doc. You know what I mean? You kind of get run out of town with the Clippers, and then you land on your feet really quickly with some, you know, very talented players. And, you know, Doc competitively, if he was, I think, drinking the truth serum, would probably admit that, you know, this is a kind of a big year for him to remind people that he knows what he's doing.
So, Sam, I have Philly as my number two team too.
Okay.
And yeah, I feel like there are caveats for every team right now. It's weird. But with Philly, the thing that's kind of driven me over the top is all the talk last year. Ultimately, if this team is going to win, it's going to win. And whichever team wins the East is going to win the East because its best players are able to play together. And the big question for Philly is, can Simmons and Embiid figure out a way to be, or this, can the Sixers figure out a way to be really, really good when Simmons and Embiid are on the floor together? And that was obviously a huge problem last year. I think it looks better this year with the two of them. And by the way, last year, that team was about even when Simmons and Embiid were on the floor. And this year, they're plus 13 when Simmons and Embiid are on the floor. That's a really big difference.
That's huge. Yeah.
Other thing that I think could help them a little bit is their number one struggle last year, no one was ever able to figure out why, but they could not win a freaking road game, and a home court advantage does not matter anymore.
Right.
So, I mean, especially not just because of...
You don't think it matters at all? Not just because of fans. Sleeping in your own bed, you know, being in your home arena?
It does somewhat, where the Warriors are on a 7-game homestand right now, and they are much more comfortable than when they are on the East Coast. Like, we imagine being on a road trip right now. Imagine being
worrying about leaving the hotel and looking at people sideways if you try to get some food. Yeah.
I mean, there's also, though, like, I'll tell you what, like, the places in the party cities are not feeling like they have the same home court advantage.
Yeah.
I give it players, unless you're in a place where clubs are open and players are defiantly not, you know, subscribing to the league's health and safety protocols and they're going out anyway. Like, you're not getting many hungover games anymore, I'll tell you that much.
The thing on Philly, Fred,
that kind of stuff.
No, I agree. But how do you feel about the offensive side of the ball with Philly? And I'm sitting here cheating. So they're 17th in offensive rating. The shooting, you know, they add Seth Curry, they add Danny Green. Conceivably, you help your shooting, and you know I lost the number, but they're not scoring the ball, and you know Ben in particular. I forget the other night. I think I heard, well, I don't want to get the wrong name. I was going to say Isaiah Thomas, but commentary on NBA TV about Ben not being aggressive and continuing to be somebody who's a fantastic playmaker, but just doesn't, you know, look to score nearly as much as they might need him to.
I'm concerned with the offense, especially in the half court. I mean, that's been a problem with them for a little while. And I think there are times it looks better, and there are times they've caught fire. I actually think Curry has been more of a shooter for them. He's kind of been like a secondary pick and roll ball handler, and has shot well off the dribble and all that for them. I mean, I think he's actually been a really, really good help for them in the starting lineup. For me, that offense can stall in the half court. The bench is not great. Like, Shake Milton can go off, but he's not going to go off every night. He's not Lou Williams.
Right.
The bench is not spectacular. I feel like they could use, you know what it feels a little like? It feels like that year a couple of years ago when they got Bellinelli and Ilyasova, and all of a sudden they were a totally different team because they needed those two bench reinforcements. This feels like the kind of year where they really need the two buyout guys,
right,
who can just help their bench, really need to make the trade.
Beyond the arc, so they're hitting 0.3 more three-pointers this year than they did compared to last year, 11.9 compared to 11.6. So, I mean, I guess where is the growth mostly on the Embiid front? You know, where else is the improvement coming from?
Well, in their best moments, I think you can piece together lineups that make more sense is the difference. Because ultimately, the rotation is going to shorten. You know, if they actually have the rotation, they just shortened for you know, inorganic reasons, but ultimately the rotation will shorten for an organic reason, and they'll be able to put together a lineup that can make sense in important moments, and they can play Danny Green, they can play Curry, and Tobias Harris is shooting the hell out of the ball this year. And you know, hopefully if they can go out and get another bench piece or two who can help them, which Daryl Morey is always aggressive, I feel like that will help them. But I'm not like totally and completely convinced they're the second best team in the East. Like, I'm willing to listen on Brooklyn. I'm willing to listen on Boston if they get Kemba back. Like, there are other teams that could easily be better than them. It's very close in my mind.
Right. Slater, who you got number two?
I'd probably go Milwaukee 2, Philly 3. Remember I put Milwaukee 2. I would say Brooklyn 3, Philly 4. Like, to me, those are clearly the top four. I actually put Miami 1, right, which, you know, I gave my reasoning. I'm living off
we're
the
gonna have. I feel like am I right? We're going to have some Boston shade here, some Celtics fans not happy with us?
You know, yeah, probably. There's the idea of Kemba Walker will come back and solve it, but Kemba Walker has persistent knee issues kind of that seem right to be lingering, really hurt them in the playoffs. They lost Gordon Hayward basically for nothing. You know, there was rumblings that maybe they could do the sign and trade of Gordon Hayward for Miles Turner. Miles Turner leads the NBA in blocks right now. I mean, I'm not putting Indiana in my top five, but they've been one of the top five best Eastern Conference teams in the first couple weeks. I would put Boston 5 because Jaylen Brown looks awesome, obviously, right now. Tatum is probably a top, what we'll say, top 15, top 20 player in the league and rising. But they're kind of thin. They're thinner than they've been. You know, we've known them as this deep team with the young guys. Like, I don't know. I don't really like their depth as much anymore. And then, you want to know the crazy one? Toronto at 2-7. I saw them lose last night in a game where Steph Curry went 2-16, worst shooting night of his career, and they still lost to the Warriors.
Right.
Pascal Siakam is probably the biggest concerning player in the Eastern Conference right now, the way he's playing.
And so weird, Kyle Lowry's been their best player, but then to see him, you know, normally the wily veteran, you know, fouling Damian Lee late and basically costing them the game was, they're in a bad place. I mean, one of our Raptors beat writers, Eric Kareen, had been tweeting about some of the silver linings the last couple of games. Pascal Siakam's playing better. You know, they seem like they're finding their way a little bit. They beat the Kings I think the Kings were up 20 plus. And they came back and won that one. But no, the Raptors are certainly not in anybody's top five right now. And now kind of spiraling towards that territory of, you know, are they going to start breaking this roster up if they don't have any hope in sight? If we pivot to good old number three, I think Slater, I'm going to go in on the Pacers in a good way, not go in on them, but the Pacers are good. And
Sam is, you know, living off this 10 game sample.
Oh, yeah.
We're taking opposite strategies.
That's what the homework was, Slater. That's what the homework.
No, the homework, right. You just said, what are your top five Eastern Conference teams? You didn't give a specific.
Well, to be fair, it wasn't even my homework. Super producer Andrew Schlecht, if you want to weigh in here and clarify, the teacher's been looming in the background of this podcast. Andrew, was it 10 game sample, or was it who's going to come out of the East for the finals?
I believe Andrew has messaged us that he's missing in action right now.
So. Fair enough. All right. Andrew is tied up elsewhere. You're right. It's early, and maybe I'm giving the Pacers too much love, but you mentioned, you know, Miles Turner doing good things. Malcolm Brogdon, you know, kind of post Milwaukee chapter, continues to prove to be an incredibly productive player. You know, Sabonis is doing good things. You know, I don't want to pretend that I've watched every minute of every Pacers game, but they look good so far from what I have seen.
They've looked really good. They look really good. Yeah, and the biggest thing, honestly, is that Oladipo looks awesome.
Right.
He looks like the Victor Oladipo of a couple years ago. That knee injury was serious. Like, that's a big deal when you miss that much time with that kind of tendon injury. I mean, those are really difficult to come back from. And he did not look great last year. He did not look great when he ended up deciding not to play and then coming back and deciding to play in the bubble. He didn't look like he did a couple of years ago. And now he's coming in a contract year, and he's been great. He's aggressive as hell. He's hitting shots. He's playing well defensively. And Sabonis, I think Sabonis has taken another leap. The way he is passing, he's always been a good passer. I've always thought he was an underrated passer. Great on dribble handoffs and that kind of stuff. Just a really good decision maker out there. But man, like, he looks so good.
You talk
so
about
good. Had his first 20-20 game the other night. He looks awesome.
You want to know a crazy
stat? You talk
stat?
About What do you guys later?
Miles Turner has 37 blocks right now, which by far leads the NBA. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams that don't have as many blocks as Miles Turner. The Mavericks, Pelicans, Wizards, Hawks, Heat, Magic. The guy's blocking like more than 4 shots a game right now. And they've Sabonis has been good. And like as Fred mentioned, he's kind of rising. They've actually, which is very different from past years, been better in the Miles Turner only minutes than the Sabonis only minutes. But, you know, a guy who's blocking 4 shots a game and can stretch out and hit to the 3. I was kind of surprised how willing Indiana seemed to be to shop him around a little. I kind of understand the weird fit, but I don't know. We'll see.
It's funny. That's one of those. Yeah, that's the thing. That's one of the pairings that everybody's assumed they were going to break up for quite some time. I wrote last year that I think going into the trade deadline that the Pacers were shopping Sabonis a bit and didn't have any takers, ended up paying him. The Oladipo subplot, it's funny because we spend so much time talking about guys who might be on the move. I didn't necessarily expect Victor to publicly, and it seems maybe privately too, to kind of just to say, no, I'm here and I'm here to be a part of this team. He's going to be a free agent next summer. I thought this would be one of those situations that might have gotten stickier by this point, as opposed to one where he's, you know, a major part of the solution for what this team is trying to accomplish this year. And you wonder if, did he just read the room basketball wise and say, this is a pretty good group, I can rock with this. And, you know, because when there had been reporting that he wanted out, and even J. Michael Falgusta, the Indianapolis Star, had reported that he told opposing players at different points of the season last year that he was looking to get out. And then Victor pushed back very hard on that story and claimed it wasn't true. So regardless, in the here and the now, he's obviously, you know, trying to do some good work with these guys.
Yeah, there's other stuff going on in the East that's interesting too. LaMelo Ball looks awesome. I think he became the youngest player to average a triple-double. Like, the Hornets look like they might be building a nice young core. I mean, not that we at all think they'll be a threat, you know, at the top of the conference at the end of the season. You mentioned the Knicks Cavaliers currently sitting in 6-7. We had a long conversation about the Hawks, you know, and Fred's Wizards. You know, maybe we should have had the conversation about Bradley Beal that we had last week. This week, he's scoring 62 in losses. I mean, at some point, he's got to be looking around.
No question.
And now Russell Westbrook is out for at least another week.
And Thomas Bryant towards ACL, which is a really tough break, obviously, as Fred knows. So, yeah, interesting conference. Sam's loving the Eastern Conference this year, by the way. You know, every time we do any of these... Yeah.
Well, we got to finish the damn list later. Come on. We got to get all the way through. I'm going Milwaukee, Philly, Indy. So let's go to Fred. Did we get your number 3?
My number 3 was Brooklyn. So spoke about my number 3.
Okay, fair enough.
I spoke about my number 3.
You're going with Brooklyn number 3. I can't give any more disrespect to the Heat any longer. So I got to put them in at number 4. Listen, like I said, I believe in what they did in the postseason. In fact, it was almost comical to watch, a two-time MVP and his group on the Milwaukee side just be pulling their hair out and you know, trying to bang their head against that wall and turn, you know, no pun intended, but not figuring out what the Heat were doing. And then even competitively not finding a way to be as locked in and as engaged as the Heat were. Jimmy Butler's got everything to do with that. I have loved his story, the post-Minnesota version of who he is and how he has fit in with this Heat culture. And I might have said this before, but in the bubble, one of my favorite personal parts of that experience was that I haven't spent a lot of sustained time around the Heat. And you always hear that phrase thrown around, Heat culture, Heat culture. Getting a more of a sense of what that means because I was around their group so much more. I walked away buying in as opposed to saying, don't believe the hype. I mean, the way they function, almost kind of militaristic approach to the game, but then, you know, the results speaking for themselves and Pat Riley setting the tone, so Miami's going to be there. I got them at number 4. What do you guys got?
I'm giving a nod to Boston at number 4.
All right.
I'm giving the nod to Boston. I just think Jaylen Brown looks... Everything Slater said was true. I think Jaylen Brown looks so good. Last year was the leap for Tatum. This year is the leap for Brown. And to me, I'm just kind of waiting to see what Kemba Walker looks like when he comes back. He's started practicing. He should be back. You know, he's going to have plenty of time to work his way back into Kemba Walker-like shape. He has a reputation for being a very hard worker. If that knee just doesn't pan out and he doesn't look like the same guy, then I'm wrong, and I probably don't have Boston at number four. But even with Gordon Hayward gone, I mean, that team still has wings. They can score. Brown is really good. They can put together really, really stout defensive lineups. For the 900th year in a row, we'll say they could probably use a little bit better of a center. But I like Daniel Theis more than the average person. I think Daniel Theis is pretty good. He's actually like a really good decision maker in the offense and a good screener, and he's active and he's a pretty good rim protector. So I like Theis, and you know, if Thompson can give him something, like, that's, it's not like they're totally absent there, and Robert Williams can jump out of the gym. So that team has some stuff. And if Kemba comes back and looks like 90% of himself, like, he doesn't have to be the second best player. I mean, he can be their third best player and still be good and play off the ball a decent amount and be a cutter and run off of screens and all that stuff and still be good and still be helpful. So I like that team. I think there's still a lot of talent, especially at the top of it. And I could see them doing some stuff for sure, but it's very dependent on Kemba.
Miami, right? Milwaukee, Brooklyn, Philadelphia, Boston. That's my top five. And that's your Boston five. At five.
All right, my five, since you want to cap it off, is the good old Nets. I mean, listen, Durant and Kevin and Kyrie early on, that was enough to, you know, cement them as top five just on its own, and they might be the best team in the East when this whole thing is said and done. Losing Dinwiddie matters. I'm, like a lot of people, very curious to watch Steve Nash throughout the season. I mean, this is a little bit like, you know, Steven Silas in Houston had a lot thrown at him and has done a pretty darn good job navigating drama, right? Well, Steven Silas has been coaching in the NBA for a very long time, and Steve Nash is still Steve Nash, and he's been around the NBA the last couple of years with the Warriors. But, you know, I would love, I mean, listen, this is the downside of COVID, is that we can't connect directly with these guys as often. I would love to really get a sense from Steve, you know, how he's holding up in terms of juggling all of this. Again, as we sit here talking, he literally just gave another update today that there is no update on Kyrie Irving. So the Nets as an entity remain, you know, somewhat unclear of what they're going to be able to have and do and accomplish. But they're my number five team. Yeah, Fred, let's finish your list off, brother.
Yeah, so my five is Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Brooklyn. Four is Boston. And five, I'm going the nod to Indiana. I feel really bad leaving Miami off, I guess, but their offense is just hasn't been good enough, and somebody's got to be left off. So,
and he picks the defending Eastern Conference champions.
Sure, I only did it because they were Slater's number one team, and I wanted to bug him.
Hey, it's all right. You probably would have had him off the list all season last season too, and then
yeah, I might have. That's true. If I had him on the list, they'd be at the bottom.
I'm going to let you go on that note. This has been a good breakdown. We talked a little bit of Hawks. We talked Eastern Conference. Appreciate you guys.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.